This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 10, When Things Go Belly Up. Well, it's a time for reflection for anyone who's an England fan. Dumped out of the World Cup, and we have a look at that. Try and get some lessons for anyone who's a coach or a player at any level to find out what kind of mistakes you can learn from that. We also answer a couple of questions as well on a more positive note. We talk about throwing and we also talk about fitness, what's necessary for cricket, and we hopefully can answer those questions in a positive way as well. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to coaching better cricket, to playing better cricket, no matter who you are in the world and no matter to where you reside. My name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things here. And as usual, I'm joined by two cricket coaches who are going to help this process of helping you get better. The first of which is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garros.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thanks. Yeah, just got back from having a very nice chat with Graham Gooch about all things cricket, especially the England situation, but more on that later. And also joining me on the line from Portsmouth Grammar School, it's the cricket professional there, it's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, how's things?
Very good, thank you, yes. Always good. Excellent. Always good to get the opinions of somebody like Graham Gooch on the world of cricket, because he's had a few experiences, hasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. Fantastic to hear what he's got to say.
So let's talk about the world of cricket, specifically England. And of course, things haven't gone particularly well for England in the 2015 Cricket World Cup. Now, well, the first thing is I want to put a proviso in here, and that this, if you want opinions on English cricket, there's plenty of places you can get opinions on English cricket. So I wanted to take a bit more of a practical view on what happened with England. Of course, not getting out of the group stage of the World Cup is below what you would have hoped for a top side like England. I guess my question around that is, after a failure like this, what can we as coaches learn from the way that England failed and apply that to our own team so we don't make perhaps the same mistakes or perhaps ignore the things that were good, that because the results haven't gone very well, they've been pushed aside?
Well, there's been lots of mistakes. I wouldn't say they've all been coaching mistakes by any stretch of imagination. But I think one of the things that has been disappointing for me, and it is a conversation I actually had with Pete last year, was about the captaincy situation with Alistair Cook, not just around one-day cricket, but also around Test cricket. And I think I've mentioned on here before that I prefer to see Cookie scoring hundreds for England rather than trying to captain the side and do everything as well as scoring runs. You know, to me, he's a run getter. And I thought we took too long to make a decision on one-day cricket, far too long to make a decision on one-day cricket. And I think we've got a decision to make in Test cricket going forward as well. And to make it a few weeks before the World Cup really didn't give Owen Morgan the right amount of time to be able to stamp his authority on the team ahead of the competition starting in earnest. And that was the first thing. And I do think that's a mistake, which has come from the selectors, of which Pete is one of them. So that's one of the areas that possibly, Pete, you can point a finger at. And I hear all the thing about stats, and I hear all the thing about motivating the top players and what have you. Pete's a very good coach. He's very experienced. And it doesn't seem to work particularly well here. But I don't think that that's the main crux of a problem for English cricket in one day. The bigger problem for me is just the lack of understanding of what is impacting upon one-day international cricket, and in fact Test cricket now, which is 2020 cricket, and none of our guys play a great deal of it because of the English schedule, because of the not getting across to the IPL, because of only a few of them playing in the Big Bash, and those ones are generally the ones that are on the outside of the England squad, let alone not the ones that are on the inside of it. And you know, 2020 cricket, from any observer, let alone an informed one, will realise that 2020 cricket has had a huge impact on one-day cricket and also Test cricket in the last couple of years. And David Warner is a classic example of that. There are hundreds of others as well.
Going back to the plan, the idea about the plan and how that kind of, for England, it fell apart a bit when Alistair Cook was in place until very late in the day, and then a new captain came in at the last minute. Is that something that we can learn for our own teams, and that consistency is very, very important? What do you think, Leivis?
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. Obviously, we probably worked at slightly different timescales than these guys. So I think if you look at a lot of the other countries around the world, their plan is probably similar to what we'll see in rugby or football, where they're almost having a four-year plan. And a four-year plan doesn't mean that they're having that team together for 4 years, but they have a process that they try and work through over 4 years. And that may be in the Germany football mould, where you can see exactly what they're trying to do, where they try and have the team together at under 21 level, and then they try and get them playing together in tournament football as a unit, rather than upgrade them to full international status and then move them on. Or it may be slightly different, where you have split your 4 years in half, and you have 2 years of investigation, experiment, looking at different options, and then you have 2 years or 18 months or whatever the time period is to then commit to a larger group, and then maybe a year to a slightly smaller group. But it's a simple plan that you can see working through phase by phase, and it's gradually narrowing down towards what's ultimately the last 6 months, where the unit has been selected, it's been committed to, and they're going to go and work for a given period of time, and they're going to get their preparation they need. Obviously, with the plan in our case, it was probably in place for that to happen and for Alistair to be the leader, and probably the plan wasn't, maybe the plan wasn't at fault, but the decision making as part of the plan was.
It's such a difficult thing, isn't it, when you're in a situation where you feel like all your planning has come to naught and you've got to do something, and it's right on the eve of of something important, and then you've got to make a decision. Do you stick with consistency and say, okay, well, you know, this plan is not working, but at least it's the plan that we've got and the plan that we've had? Or do you make a change at the last minute? That is such a catch-22, and it's a horrible decision for any kind of coach or selector to make, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a tough one, that. And I would always actually make the decision rather than not make the decision. But the disappointment for me is the fact that it took him so long to make a decision which seems so obvious from the outside. And, you know, we're not involved, but everybody felt that, not because of his cricket necessarily, but just because of the combination of the effect of captaincy, the fact that he wasn't making great decisions as a captain, or we could do with making different decisions as a captain, and the fact that he wasn't scoring enough runs. Alistair shouldn't have been in that side for a year and a half leading up to that. It should have probably been a decision that was made in the Flower and Giles era rather than in the Moores era. But Moores, he had an opportunity right at the outset, as you do with any coaching changeover, is to make a decision along the lines of captaincy, and the selectors and Pete didn't, and I think that was their failing. They probably had to make a decision in the end before the World Cup, but it was always going to have a knock-on detrimental effect to the team. I predicted 4 years ago that India would win the World Cup, A, because they were at home, but that didn't guarantee them anything because of the pressure that was associated with it, but mostly because of the connection between Dhoni and Kirsten. And you don't go too far beyond that. Who's going to win the World Cup this time round? Well, I'd be struggling to look beyond New Zealand or Australia, both of which have got fantastically strong leadership between coaches and captain. Now, somebody else might come along and play better on any given day, but those guys give themselves a chance because they've got great leadership at the top.
It's become a bit of a cliche also to say, well, let's take the positives from this. It's one of those things that people like to scoff at, but it is an effective way of analysing performance. If you take away the actual result and you look at what was good and what was bad across the performance. So just because you lost a game doesn't mean everything that you tried went completely wrong. So as a case study, really, more than anything, what would you say the positives were that England could take from this World Cup?
I'll let you start on that one, Leivis.
Thanks, Gareth. First of all, I think one positive would probably be that James Taylor has proved he can play at that level, and there's been probably surrounding the whole KP book as well, and it was a bit of commentary around that to suggest that James Taylor couldn't play at this level. He's shown he can. He maybe hasn't shown he can do it to this consistent standard that is required at that level, but he's shown he's got an ability to do so. Josh Butler again has shown that, again, maybe not with the consistency that we'd like, but he's shown that he definitely has the ability to be a match winner, and potentially if we can put him in better positions rather than having him coming in trying to save games or rescue games, we're allowing him to go and shine like a Glenn Maxwell or Ava de Villiers can do, then I think he's one guy that stands out and looks like he could be in that world-class player bracket with in years to come. Beyond that, there haven't been a lot. Gareth, have you managed to think of one yet?
The key thing for me is what they do structurally. We need to get our guys playing more 2020 cricket. We need to change our organisation of test matches to allow some of our better international players to play some 2020 cricket. And we need to think about how we can get our players into different environments around the world where they learn stuff. And the disappointment for me is that one of the things that KP was always looking to do was to go to the IPL, not because he's solely into money. I'm sure that was an important element of it, but it's not the only bit. He wanted to go there to expand his skills, and he was encouraging England players to go out there to do exactly that. And the rest of the world have embraced it and moved on, particularly in the batting areas of the game. And England, as a result of lack of exposure, haven't. So, you know, I know I'm a bit biased maybe towards KP, but that was one of his arguments, which I think has come to bite us in the backside a little bit.
Well, with my pitch vision cap on, rather than having the England fan cap on, there are things that anyone can learn, as you know, is take England as a cautionary tale, and there are things that anyone can learn about the way that you run a team and the way that a team performs at a tournament or over a season. So there's definitely things that you can take from there, even if you're not as interested in the success of the England team as perhaps the three of us are. So hopefully that's been a relevant discussion for you, no matter where you are. But let's wrap it up now with the yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more the team want to say. So I've got the first question. Let's get started. First question. Innovation trumps tradition.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. Everyone should bowl at sloggers in the nets.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question. Conflict creates results.
No.
Yes.
It's time now on the show for the questions section. We dip into the mailbag and we pick out a couple of questions that have been asked by listeners to this show. And we do our very best to answer those questions. And the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy and pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions in to us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And the first question is from Mark, who is a big fan of the podcast. He sent in his praise to us, which I won't read. But he says, I'm a coach and I love baseball. I think we can learn a lot from the game. And I know that lots of throwing coaches now work with cricketers. I've watched my fair share of baseball throwing mechanics and drills. And my question is about arm slots. In baseball, fielders and pitchers all have different throwing techniques, short, long or flat. Many videos talk about the thrower's arm slots varying from vertical to horizontal. What is arm slots all about? I hope you can help answer this. Throwing is an art, and most cricketers I see have custard arms, which is a little embarrassing considering it's a skill used as much as batting, bowling and catching. So custard arms, what can we do about it?
Well, custard arms and arm slots, whilst they're connected, the custard arm comes from stuff that happens before the arm slot becomes relevant.
I love that name, by the way. That's just brilliant.
Yeah, it's a good one. I might use it. Actually, yeah. I might have that one, Mark, if that's okay. But arm slots, let's go to that first. An arm slot really is the shape of the throwing arm in preparation and at point of release. So if we look at a run out that's come from the World Cup in the last few days, you've got Michael Clarke got a vital run out in their game against Sri Lanka, where he ran out Jai Wardner. So as Michael Clarke picked the ball up at mid-off and prepared to throw, he had a, what we'd call a vertical arm slot. So he had a 90-degree angle coming straight out the side of his shoulder, and his and he threw it from high to low. So he really came down on the back of the ball, and he had that 90-degree shoulder height with his release point above his head. And he was never missing because he had a very vertical arm slot, and the ball was never missing his intended target. He had 2.5 stumps to aim at, and it was a foregone conclusion as soon as he aligned his feet properly, because he's got a very vertical arm slot. So there's an arm slot in a vertical term. The horizontal one you might see when people pick the ball up and the ball's gone laterally to your attacking side. To me, as a right-handed thrower, I'd pick the ball up on my right side, and because I need to get rid of the ball quickly, so it might be a tight line throw, and I need to throw the ball back across myself to hit the stumps with maybe a guy diving to try and get into the crease, I would release the ball again with a 90-degree angle. But because of the tilt of my body from a torso, I pick the ball up low because I bent down to get it, and then I deliver my throw from low. So my arm slot is still 90 degrees, but it's a horizontal one. I'm releasing it in a non-vertical fashion to hit the stumps. And that's a more difficult skill because you've got your release position to try and contend with, as well as your momentum going away from the target, which is different from the Michael Clark, Jaya Wardner run out the other day. So in both cases, you're looking to get that 90-degree angle because that helps you to be safe, and also it increases your chance of hitting the stumps. So that is arm slot in essence. How you position itself, how that is positioned, is a relationship to your body and how you've broken your torso, whether you're bending down low to pick up the ball, or whether you've picked up the ball and then stood up tall like Michael Clark did the other day to run out Jaya Wardner.
And that harder skill is very rarely practiced, but you know, because coaches obviously are going for what is going to give you the highest percentage results, I suppose. And you know, if you see someone throwing in that second way, then you think, well, you know, that's a lot harder, so you're going to be a lot less accurate, so just don't do it in the first place. But there are always going to be situations where you are going to need to throw in a non-optimal way, right? And so in that situation, it's something that you do need to practice.
And you do. And Will Linton, who worked with me with Ireland for the last World Cup, the 2011 World Cup, he talked about arm slots a lot. And I was of the opinion that you did exactly what you just said, David. You know, you get people to stand up and throw with a vertical arm slot. But, of course, the situation dictates that if you do that, you're not going to get the run out, even if you're a direct hit. And we actually had Kevin O'Brien, was absolutely fantastic, as was Will Porterfield, at picking the ball up and throwing with that correct 90-degree arm slot. But, of course, it's in more of a horizontal position. And they got really masterful at getting their release points right, and they were hitting the stumps from everywhere. And that was down to Will taking, breaking down convention, I suppose, in cricket, because baseball has been doing it for years, which is what Mark talks about in his question, and actually applying it to cricket. And as a result, and I've spoken about it before on the show and in presentations that I do, we went from being the worst at the 2010 World Cup in terms of stump hits to being the best across the 2011 World Cup. And that was all down to Will Linton's work, great work with the guys, but also the way that the players bought into it and the way that they practiced as well, using this arm slot either in a vertical and horizontal, and sometimes even in a 45 degree, because you could be in a position where you can stand up a little bit, but then you realise you've got to let go of the ball and you have to throw from that. But the 90 degrees is the crucial thing within any throw.
I guess the good thing is you don't need to understand a huge amount of theory to be able to set it up where people are working on those kind of throws, because it comes naturally to do those kind of throws if you feed the ball into the right space. So you can set up a drill and let people do a lot of the working out for themselves if you're not intervening too much and telling people they're doing it wrong, if they're doing it in a way that is getting the ball out as quickly as possible, but maybe not quite as accurate because it's more difficult to do. But as you said in your course, Garrett's the first class fielding on the videos there, if you get one run out a year from something which you've practiced that is more difficult, but you know you may be only hitting a very small percentage of it, but if you get one run out a year from it, it's worth every moment of practice then, isn't it?
Well, I think so, particularly if you look back at that game. And I know it was a more basic run out in terms of being a vertical arm slot throw from Michael Clarke. But Jarl Wardner is a serious player. He's batting with Sangakkara. They're making a good fist of a big run chase. And all of a sudden, in one ball, you've run that guy out. Well, that's game over. Let's be honest. You know, the pressure got completely transferred on Sangakkara, and he wasn't able to come through for once. It is that run out. And particularly if it's a game changer, it's worthwhile doing it. And as you said, it's fun. And what you just talked about, really, rather than coaching the intention, coaching the action of get your arm slot like this or whatever, feed the ball in different angles and just get people to have a go at it. So you're coaching the intention rather than the action. Having the knowledge as a coach about what the arm slot should look like is fantastic. But then we need to watch what people are doing and adapt our coaching accordingly. But, you know, chucking balls left, right and centre and just ultimately having fun is the best way of going about it, because you're coaching the intention by feeding the ball a bit wider than you would do if... you know, by saying, and then you need to do this, and then you need to do that, and then you need to pick your hand up, which has been the way that, you know, we've coached a long time, and I certainly did a few years ago. That
is a really important thing, is just create an environment and let them go sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not something you want to do every single session all the way through, but if you find a balance where you can include that, it's really valuable for their independent learning.
Yeah, exactly. And even if it's not, you know, even if not hitting the stumps every time, that's not necessarily a sign of failure on a difficult skill. So it's you have to use your judgment as a coach to be able to think about what is being effective, what's getting the ball out quickly, you know, what's, as you said, Garrett, you know, as you always put it so succinctly, it's the intention. Next question is from Gaurav. Gaurav says, what fitness is necessary for cricket? Now, that's a short question, but the reason I put it in this week is because we had another question from a chap called Taha, who actually sent this question in twice. He phoned us up and he emailed us. Three times, because he sent it on Facebook as well. So he really wanted to know.
He was keen, wasn't he?
He was super keen. And the question was very long, but very specific. He wanted to know exactly what type of program, down to the exercises, and what type of nutrition he should have. And he gave us all his details about how old he was and what skills he had and how tall he was. I thought it wouldn't really be fair to go into fine detail when we didn't really know enough about Taha. So I've taken Gaurav's question and integrated it in. And hopefully it's something that we can talk about, because there's been a lot of talk about, I think, fitness in cricket recently. Steph Jones is talked about it a lot and how it links in with technique and all that kind of thing. So we know fitness is important, but what's the latest thinking on the role of strength and conditioning in cricket and how it's evolved in the last couple of years?
Well, I think it's always been there, isn't it? And particularly in the last 10 years, I think we've made huge strides in the awareness. And we're getting to that stage now where we're becoming a little bit more informed about how to go about it. And that comes from people's experience over the last 10 years. And they're starting to write about it. They're starting to write about the things that they got right and about the things that they got wrong. Because that's how we formulate the best way going forward. So for me, it's about age. I think it's about age and not so much chronological age, but biological age, where that person is at and what they're ready to take on board. Because as you quite rightly said a minute ago, it is a huge area. So I've just sat down an hour ago with my strength and conditioning coaches, putting together a fast bowling fitness program, which effectively starts when they get to lower sixth. And before that, it's all about what do they need to be able to do, be able to get from level one to level two to level three, to then have a more specific program when they get to 16 years old. So we've put four or five levels together that they go through. Here are some criteria in terms of how do they move, how do they stop, how do they plyometrically jump, how can they, how well do they hold glute bridges, all of those things. How that progresses until we can get to a point of putting some really specific fast bowling stuff around them, because there's no point in starting that process until you've got a foundation from which to work from. So I don't care whether you're 13 or 25, there's no point in getting really specific with some of the drills that Steph does, because you won't necessarily be ready for them. When you're ready for them, they'll be fantastic you to have, but it's all about getting that athlete together before you start becoming really specific, and that's the key message for me. So I can't give you the holy thing, because we have to look at where people are, because you're not going to train a 13-year-old who's not even started to reach peak height velocity in the same way as you're going to train a 25-year-old. The question for me is, what are the basic athletic skills like underneath? Because if you've got those in place, you've got a foundation to then decide how specific and how hard you can go in certain areas.
Athlete is a great word, I think, because that kind of sums up what fitness is necessary for cricket, because you can just spread out the tendrils of what that might be over as wide as you like, depending on all the other variables that you have. I mean, as you said, Gareth, it all depends on age and training experience and what access to what equipment you've got and what type of coaches you've got. You know, a lot of guys will have no access to any kind of fitness coach at all, you know, let alone somebody who is a strength and conditioning coach who understands the specific requirements of cricket. But if you go back to that idea of saying what my fitness for cricket is turning me into an athlete, and when I'm an athlete, I'm going to be able to better put my skills into practice. I'll be able to hit the ball harder, I'll be able to run faster, I'll be able to go longer without getting tanked, I'll be able to stay on the pitch for longer because I'm less injured, and I'll be able to get into better positions for my technical work because I've got the stability and the mobility to be able to do that. Then that is the real sort of reduced simplicity of it to me. Unfortunately, underneath that is the huge complexity of strength and conditioning, which is very complex, and that makes it hard for us to answer on the podcast.
I think one of the difficult things as well is that obviously it's people are more aware of it now than they were 10 years ago. You know, I reckon what one out of every 6 or 7 questions that we get, and maybe even more than that, David, is geared around strength and conditioning. So there's a real awareness and interest in what it is. I suppose where I've been lucky throughout my professional life, and not necessarily as a player, I might add, but certainly since I've been a coach, is I've always had experts around me and really good strength and conditioning coaches around me who have helped given me an understanding of their role and also some of the techniques that they use. But the danger for me, and we had a discussion earlier about this here at school, is that if we start to get the strength and conditioning, the coaches around the world, the cricket coaches around the world, watching videos and doing quite complex strength and conditioning things without any really formal education in the specifics to look for, or how to teach the motion, then we could be opening up a bit of a can of worms. To me, what can we get kids doing, which is where most people get coached, isn't it, as kids? It's, can we get them moving around a lot? Can we get them being strong in things like lunges and squats without any weight and all of those things that are really simple to do? Can we make sure that they're flexible? Can we make sure that they understand how to warm down properly and recover after matches? Can we give them a self-awareness and a self-responsibility to make sure that their drinks bottles are always full and they're hydrated? Can we get them sprinting, rolling and diving and pushing themselves back up? Because if we can get those things in place, we then give the strength and conditioning coaches a real good athlete, as we say, to work with. But to me, I'm not going to get any more specific than that, even with all of the knowledge that I've acquired over the years, because I'm not going to start teaching people squats and deadlifts and things like that, which is where a lot of the stuff that's going around the internet at the moment is trying to get coaches to go. That's a dangerous place. So I'd steer away from that and get specialist help in when you get somebody who needs to go.
Yeah, it's another one of those aspects, isn't it, Lavers, that if you've got a good basic understanding, then you can. There's certain things that you can do, but you also need to know your limitations as a coach. And you don't want to start doing anything that's a little bit too funky just because you've seen it online. You want to make sure that it's based on a foundation. And if you're not sure, it's best to refer out to somebody who does know what they're talking about.
I completely agree. I often compare this to something that Dave Brailsford always talked about. And he's famous for talking about one percenters and trying to squeeze the extra 1% or 2% or 0.5% out of people. But you don't go looking for 1%ers until you've done the 10, 20, and 30%ers. And a lot of people start looking at exciting drills and things that you see people doing at international level or first class level, or people who are part of a really specific program and you see them doing it. And people want to do it and people want to get involved in that. And it's completely understandable because they see it, it's new to them, it looks specific, it looks like it's relevant to bowling or batting or whatever it may be. But it's probably a one percenter. And there's only any value in working on that top 1% if you've got that foundation, which is a word you used a few minutes ago, you've got that foundation underneath that gives you the building blocks to base it on. There's no point getting involved in some very, very specific exercises if you can't jump, you can't run and change direction and accelerate and decelerate. You can't do these functional movements which are key to everyday life, never mind cricket. So I think try to, just another story, I remember when I joined my cricket club, I got asked to take over as head coach there. One of the things that someone said to me is, I think we're doing really well, we need to work on the one percenters. And I said, oh, that sounds great, that'd be really interesting. And within weeks, I realised that the one percenters were going to be the last thing on my mind. And the first thing were the basics and the building blocks of technique, the building blocks of fitness and tactical awareness and things like that. And now we're getting to a stage where certain individuals probably can start to look more into the one percenters, whether they be with technique or fitness or whatever it may be, but they've got those building blocks and fundamentals in place. So just try and be quite honest with yourself when you're looking at fitness development and assess where you are on that spectrum. Are you at the high end where you can look at intricate, advanced, complicated drills, and they're going to have a direct benefit because you've ticked all the boxes below and you've built all those building blocks below, or are you in a position where you're still building, and even though they look pretty and they look exciting, just they maybe need to hold off and leave them for another year or another couple of years until your fundamentals are all in place.
Now it's time for the soapbox. That is 60 seconds uninterrupted. One of the team gets to talk about anything that's on their mind, as long as it's cricket related. And this week is Sam Lavery. So, Lavers, over to you for the soapbox.
Thanks, David. I want to talk about batmakers this week. And I've actually got a pretty good friend of mine who is a batmaker, and I won't mention his name or advertise his company in this slot. But one of the things I found fascinating the last couple of weeks is the difference in support you can get and the difference in quality you can occasionally get between big bat companies and your local bat maker. And one of the things I'm starting to realise is that my friend concerned and a couple of other local guys who make bats, they work really hard. They usually have a full-time job as well, and they put everything they've got into their company, only for a lot of other people to go and buy one online and spend £300 or £400. And I think that if you can support your local bat maker, you will generally find that he will support you. And the after sales experience and the repair work and all the other things that come with it have been fascinating, have been incredibly impressive with two or three guys I know locally. So if you do have someone around, try and support them, support your local bat maker, go and see them and see what they can do to help you, because you'll probably find you get more from them than a big company.
And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. We're going to head off and back to our relevant cricket areas. But before we go, we just need to decide on a winner of this week's competition, which is, of course, the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, we had two questions, as always. The first was from Mark about throwing, and the second was from Gaurav and sort of from Taha about fitness. Which one did you prefer this week?
I'm going to go with Mark's one, because I'm a big fielding fan, as you know, David, and it very much links into the stuff that's on the course, first-class fielding as well. So, Mark, this week, all yours, mate.
Well done, Mark. Maybe first-class fielding is the course for you, but get in touch with us and let us know which one you want. Speaking of getting in touch, Gareth, what if somebody wanted to do that? They wanted to get in touch and send in their question, just like Taha did, in all the different ways that he could possibly do it. How would they be able to do that?
Well, they could give us a ring, David, on 0203 239 7543, or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. As I mentioned before, we do take questions on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, or even Twitter, @pitchvisionacad is our handle there. If you want to listen to the show, that's pretty easy to do these days. You pick up your phone or your tablet, you open up the podcast app that you use most often, and you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in all the main ones. If you want to do it in the old school way and use the RSS feed or get the show notes or just stream it online, which some people still do, then you can go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link. You'll have all the details for how to subscribe in there or stream or listen to old shows, whatever you want to do. They're all on the site there. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.